On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Slate's XX GabFest is sponsored by Smith & Noble, featuring custom window treatments handcrafted to your personal style, design, and color preferences. Get 20% off your window treatments, plus a free in-home consultation when you go to smithandnoble.com/XX. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. Visit blueapron.com/XX to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/XX. And by The Great Courses, offering engaging audio and video lectures taught by top professors. Courses like Understanding the Mysteries of Human Behavior. Right now, get up to 80% off the original price when you visit thegreatcourses.com/XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, May 14th, the Selfish in Thailand edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic, and I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog, and back from the UK. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
We missed you.
Oh, thank you.
You didn't miss us.
I didn't say I didn't miss you, but, well, I didn't say I did either, did I?
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks to all our listeners who gave us examples of awesome and not such self-absorbed Instagrams that we should look at. They have been collected on our Facebook page, XX GabFest, so check them out and add some of your own. Thank you. Our three topics for today. First, the nail salon blockbuster expose in the New York Times about how nail salons both exploit and poison their workers. Second, Kim Kardashian's new book, Selfish, and The Art of the Selfie. And third, men hate their work-life balance just as much as women, a new study shows, but they deal with it in completely different ways. Before we begin, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast, is coming to North Carolina. If you live near the Triangle region, come watch a live taping of the show with hosts Allison Benedict and Dan Coyce on Sunday, June 7th at Motor Co. Do we think that's like a car?
I'm sure it's just the hippest place in town.
Yeah, it's definitely the hippest place in town, no doubt. I'm just wondering if it's like has cars involved.
Sounds to me like a brewery, if I had to guess.
I think it's where people go and rave in their cars.
Moms and dads especially, especially. Go and rave in their cars. Yeah. So anyway, the evening special guest will be Mac McCann of the band Superchunk. He'll talk with Allison and Dan about indie rock dadhood, his new solo album Nonbelievers, and parenting triumphs and fails. And he'll perform live. If you're a Slate Plus member, you get a 30% discount on your ticket purchase. So get your tickets at slate.com/momanddadlive. Okay. So let's jump into our first topic. The New York Times expose this weekend was horrifying to read about how nail salon workers are virtual indentured servants. They get paid well below the minimum wage, and they get exposed to sickening chemicals. We will talk about the story and about how guilty you should feel about your pleasures. So, ladies, I will ask you first, what stands out to you? There are many amazing anecdotes in the story about how, say, nail salon employees have to pay their employers $100, and they have to somehow work for free 12-hour days until they themselves get paid, and then they get paid something like $30 a day. What of those details, first we'll start with the exploitation, stuck out for you guys as remarkable? Because frankly, I've read lots of stories about this, but this one really made a big explosion.
Well, I think there's an additional detail, which is that tips and wages are often just skimmed or confiscated. To me, the worst detail of the story, there was one woman who I believe worked at a salon on the Upper East Side, and she accidentally spilled nail polish remover on a client's shoe.
A Prada sandal.
A Prada sandal. And, you know, the woman complained and demanded to be paid for her damaged shoe. And the salon owner or manager you know, paid her, I think, $250, $270, which she had garnished from the woman's, from the salon worker's wages. And then the woman was then fired. And the quote she gave, which just is an awful, terrible way to feel, is she said, "I am worth less than a shoe." Mm. So that's what stood out to me.
Yeah. How about you, June?
I guess the thing that was, I mean, it is an amazing piece of reporting and just a great kind of, it's one of those things that every paragraph seems to have something. But I guess the thing that, it's not necessarily surprising, but that just kind of jumped out at me was that what the authors of the piece claimed was the sort of almost racial hierarchy in salons, you know, with Koreans at the top and Chinese or other Asian workers in the middle and Latinos at the bottom or Latinas at the bottom, which, you know, is not, you know, when you sort of think, it's one of those things. Like, I guess one thing that is great about this piece or this series is that so much of it is stuff that when you think about it, you go, oh, yeah, I should not really be surprised by that, or I shouldn't, you know, be having my little first world response to that and be shocked. But it did kind of shock me.
Yeah, that was uncomfortable. There were many uncomfortable things about the story, and one of them was the ethnic hierarchies, that Koreans control the nail salons, they pay Korean workers better, you know, than as Chinese and Latino workers, much worse. That's not really how you want to think of the world, and it scrambles our normal ideas about exploitation, which is like the white and rich exploit everybody else. So that was weird and uncomfortable. Somehow the pictures of where the women lived depressed me, you know, this idea of them being bussed hours to these nail salons, living in these terrible conditions, and then working 12 hours silently, you know, working on people's feet. I think also the idea that feet were like the dog duty.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
And
like,
men's feet especially.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't think about, I mean, you just don't think about there being a hierarchy, but probably if you thought about it for 1 second, you would realize that there is, of course, a hierarchy. Let me ask you guys a personal question. Have you ever thought about this before? What's your relationship with manicures or pedicures? And has this, you know, exploitation occurred to you as you were getting them?
So I never really got them before moving to New York. They are expensive outside of New York City. In Cleveland, where I'm from, I think, you know, a manicure pedicure can run you well over $75. And it just is culturally just not as much of a thing. And when I first moved to New York, I like was basically subsistence living, and I never got them either. But they, as I made slightly more money and sort of started to look around at the, you know, the nails of my cohort, I realized that I was the only one not getting
them. You gotta up your nail game.
Yeah, so I upped my nail game. So I do get pretty regular pedicures. And when I first started going, I found it uncomfortable that you're sort of literally being waited on hand and foot, and then you very, very quickly become used to it, and that becomes kind of fun, and then you stop thinking about the awkwardness of the encounter, which is a terrible thing to admit, but I think is a fairly common experience. And so then I read this article and, you know, and stared at my feet, which I'd gotten a pedicure at a place that was name checked in this article.
Oh,
I was reading along and I was like, well, not the places I go. You know, I go to places where I'm sure they treat people well because they seem like on the up and up. And this nail salon chain, Iris Nails in Brooklyn, the one I go to is in Brooklyn, was name checked as a place where the owner made incredible profits and people were not paid well. Yeah. So that's my personal history of professionally done pedicures. What about you, June?
I've never been in one, partly because I can't stand anybody touching my feet, much less like have being worked on. And I guess my relationship to them is just of late, like really in the last few months. There was a stat in the piece that said like maybe in 2012 there were 2,000 of these salons in New York City. And I thought, in the last couple of months, that many have opened like on my street. It just feels like there's been this boom in like anytime a building on 7th Avenue in Brooklyn, which is, you know, not a residential street but a commercial street, every time there's an empty building, which has been happening more and more in the last couple of years, a nail salon moves in. And now on some blocks there are two or three that have literally opened up in the last 2 or 3 months. And I guess it's something that you can't not mention, but I had wondered how they were making money when nothing else apparently could. At the same time, like, now I know, well, okay, exploitation, ignore all the rules, But if the rents were too high for everyone else and the cost is so low, then I still don't really quite get how...
Well, the demand is so high. Once you start getting them, you get hooked very instantly because it is like an affordable luxury. It costs less to get, which is the whole problem,
right.
Which is the whole premise of this piece. But it costs less in New York to get your nails done than to have a cocktail, which is crazy. So and it feels great. You know, it's just a little tiny oasis. And I think just people have realized that over the past few years and demand has skyrocketed.
What about you, Hannah?
You know, I'm waiting patiently here because I occupy the moral high ground on this issue.
Oh, God. Oh,
waiting
God.
To
Are you higher than me? Are you higher than me on this high ground?
I am, because I had the realization that was confirmed by the story. Basically, what happened to me is I go to a lot of yoga classes. I saw everyone's toes like you did, Noreen, and I was like, I really got to up my nail game. And then I went to Queens one day. Queens is name checked all over this story with my mom. And, you know, she's like, you know, why don't you go in here and get your nails done? And it was like $10. And I thought, okay, something is really, really wrong. Like, I understand the theoretical issue, the democratization of luxury, that things like spas and people, you know, sort of waiting on you hand and foot used to be something we associated with the rich. Those have become increasingly middle class and even working class luxury, that everybody can enjoy the same things that the rich used to enjoy. So that's good, right? The democratization is maybe good. But $10 seemed sick to me. I was like, there is no way.
For a pedicure?
That's so cheap.
That's insane.
Yeah. But okay, salons in Queens, where I grew up, is $10. The salon that Nicki Minaj went to in her video, the Nicki Minaj MTV thing was like, it's like around the block from my house. Okay. So like they are really cheap. And I just thought something has to be wrong. And then June, the same thing happened that happened with you, where in my neighborhood, a bunch of places closed down and every one of them got replaced by a nail salon. So I was like, it's just not possible. Like, this is just bizarre. Yeah. So I did some Googling and this stuff comes up. Like piecemeal, it comes up. And I went through the buzzkill period. I was like, oh, what a bummer. And then I got my Brazilian sister-in-law, who knows how to do all this stuff, to teach me how to do my own nails.
Yeah.
And she did. And so, like, since, you know, it's been a few years and I start, because I couldn't take it. It was just creeping me out. I just couldn't deal with it. Like, once the price dropped so low, it just freaked me out. But it's like, okay, this is dilemmas that we face. Like,
right.
there's a Korean spa. There used to be one in New York. There's now one in D.C. Somebody sent me an article. And I love the Korean spa, and everyone in my family loves it. It's one of those places you go for, you know, where there are saunas. And, you know, someone sent me an article that it was in our local alternative paper about how they exploit their workers. And, you know, perhaps there's prostitution in the back and God knows what happens. So you got to think like, oh, shit. You know, here is something that gave me genuine pleasure that maybe you had a little bit of like class or race or whatever guilt about, but you might have done anyway. So I bet now all of New York, because this was a really great and convincing series, is having this thought. So I'm going to put you on the spot, Noreen, which is, you know, can you do it anymore? Like, everybody must be thinking this, right? Like, surely all your colleagues, all your friends are like, can I actually walk my feet into that nail salon after reading this New York Times?
I think there is going to be a depression in the nail game for a while. Like, I think people will temporarily stop. I don't know if it will be permanent. I think it will be. This will be a great boon, in a weird ironic twist, to a lot of the sort of higher end, maybe white owned nail salons. There's one called 10 over 10 that's very big with the fashion ladies, where you like have to make an actual reservation and it costs about three times as much. And I bet they are, you know, enjoying a surge in business. So this is the great dilemma, right? Do you stop going and then put these women out of a job? Do you tip more with the thought that, like, maybe it will go to them, maybe it will go to their bosses? My great hope is actually that getting your nails painted will become unfashionable. And as much as I do find the experience enjoyable, it really, whatever, it's fun. But part of it is just, like, you don't want to be the only person with gross nails. And if the definition of what a gross nail is, like, I don't actually have gross nails when they're unpainted. It's just that I've gotten socially, you know, trained to think that it's gross if they're not hot pink or whatever. And if you look around and no one else's are, then I could save myself, you know, $30 a month or whatever it is.
Well, here's a generational question, and maybe you guys remember this from your moms, because I was trying to remember myself. So my mother used to do up a lot of stuff. Like in Israel, everybody would like wax and, you know, and use those eyebrow strings and iron your hair. It's not like women didn't work at it, but it was mostly received wisdom. Like your mother would teach you how to do these things. You wouldn't go somewhere and have it done unless you were really rich. So I wonder if that's a solution. Like I don't think women are going to walk around with like mangy toes and bunions and stuff like that. But like, you know, the return of like the art of womanly self-maintenance, like, would that be more annoying because you just don't have time for it?
I'm not sure about that because I grew up in a very working class, you know, village, and really the only place where women, and even though there were lots of pubs in the village at that point, they're all closed now, by the way, but women didn't really go to the pub even with their husbands. So the place where they could have fun was at the hair salon, and the hair salon didn't do nails, but they would go to the chiropodist because everybody had a problem with their feet for some reason. So
the what?
The chiropodist. It's a big thing in England, and I don't think it exists elsewhere.
I've never even heard that word.
It's like a guy who works on your feet, like your bunions and your corns or whatever. They don't really paint nails, I don't think. But, you know, so it's a more medical. It's not a sort of beautifying thing. But it was, I think, almost a treat, you know. And if you didn't get your bunions seen to, that was considered, you know, whatever. And so I do think that there's always been and always will be just a sense that this is something that doesn't necessarily cost too much, but you get this feeling of community and being spoiled and not having a totally sucky life. Now, I guess, never having been in one of these places, I don't really know how it is, but I gleaned from the piece that especially if you, because the language skills are often, no, I shouldn't say language skills, but English language skills are often low, that there isn't a kind of a conversational thing, as in, like, I used to go with my mom to the hair salon when she got her hair done, and it was this big, big gossip session. And it doesn't seem like that really happens in this kind of setting, right?
Yeah, I think people are more hoping for an oasis or something. Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about the generational thing, though, Hannah. My grandmother got her hair done every week. She never, like, washed it herself.
Mm-hmm. My mom
have it set. And then my mother, this is the other side of the family, but my mother was sort of came of age in the 70s with a sort of hippie aesthetic. And so she was very, very low maintenance with grooming. So she never taught me any of the, like, you know, she never taught me to pluck my eyebrows. She was like, you look great just the way you are. Why would you wear makeup? You know, and then I sort of had to discover, you know, so I can't paint my nails. I'm terrible at it. And I wonder if there's some of that other people have, these like hippie free to be you and me mothers where we and then Sex and the City came along and we were like, give us the waxes right now. We'll pay for it.
Oh, my God, that's
it.
So true. Yeah. I realize what a disservice I've done to my daughter because I'm that hippie parent now, whereas my mother was like, sit down when I was 7 years old. Here's how you cook wax. Like, we would cook wax every weekend, and she would wax my whole body, like my legs, my arms, like everything. It was like an entire hair removal production happening in the Rosen household every weekend, starting at the age of 7. So I'm like well-versed. I could open like a hair removal salon right now if I wanted to.
But that's like, there's a beautiful kind of female bonding in that, right? Like, on the occasions when my mother did sort of primp to go out, I loved watching her. I loved having her show me how to do stuff. My older sisters, and now you sort of, when you get dressed with friends before a wedding or whatever, doing makeup together, it's just there's a ritual of female bonding that I think for some people happens at the nail salon. You know, you'll go with your friend and you'll read magazines in tandem. Anne Friedman actually wrote a great column for this in The Cut about the idea of female bonding that happens in nail salons. And I don't know if there's an equivalent space for men. I'm sure, you know, they have lots of spaces.
I have to say too, though, that I get that nail salons, especially in New York, are very cheap. I remember when I moved to New York being told that, you know, there are three things that are cheaper in New York: getting your nails done, buying flowers, and I don't remember what
dry
the third
cleaning.
One. Dry cleaning, yeah. Although it still seems awfully expensive.
Yeah, I think that one's not true anymore.
Yeah. But I guess because, you know, so many people do it because it's in your neighborhood, because there's so many of them, and because this piece was very good, it's in your face. But let's face it, there are a lot of things that we get that are really too cheap to not be completely exploitative. Like, sometimes I'll go into certain stores for clothes because I'm cheap, and the clothes are so cheap you think, well, the only way this could have been made was essentially by slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Yet I'm cheap and I kind of like the clothes sometimes, and I don't even know what. If yes, I want to be a responsible consumer. I don't want to be exploiting people. I don't want to be a slaver, you know, but it's really hard, or it's very easy to give yourself an excuse.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And the culture of cheap, I think that's the name of the book on this subject, The Culture of Cheap.
Yeah.
But the idea of, you know, what happens in outlets and where these clothes come from and how they're all made is a larger topic. So you can't just hold your moral high ground by saying, I'm never going to a nail salon again, because you basically, you know, if you want to do this right, you buy clothes made in America that mm-hmm. are always like tremendously more expensive. Like, I went into a store the other day and I asked how much this jacket was, and it was linen, and it was really expensive. And I asked why, and she said because they're all made in America and sewn by people who are paid decent wages. And, you know, I really had to think, am I really going to pay that much money for a jacket? You know, I
did
really
you buy
didn't
it?
Want to. I did buy it.
All right, good for you.
I was totally bought. I was totally sold on that, like, made in America, you know, decent wage argument. The last thing before we leave this topic is the second part of the series was about medical evidence mm-hmm. about chemicals and poisoning, and I found some of that convincing and some of that speculative. And I just wanted to check if you guys had that same response, because there is always a sense that, you know, chemicals are dangerous and poisonous, but there's never like really, really strong evidence for it. There were some about kind of rashes and people having allergic reactions, but then there were much more serious stories that were less well documented. And I wanted to see what your guys' reaction to that was.
I think my response was a little bit of what you said, like it didn't feel like the scientific evidence was quite nailed down at the same time.
No pun intended. Oh. Sorry.
At the same time, though, I was totally convinced, because it makes perfect sense. Like, it's the kind of thing that you don't need much convincing about, because those things are stinky and they give you a headache. You just sort of open the bottle. And so if you're around that stuff for 10 or 12 hours a day, of course it's going to mess you up. And the whole idea of self-regulation is always a joke. I mean, it's ironic, because I think nail salons and a lot of things in this country are way over-regulated. There's way excessive licensing. And so at the same time, it seems like if you're going to have rules, at least, you know, have people who would go out and, you know, inspect these places and try and make sure that things are being done according to the rules.
Well, this series was so good that you're already, like, the mayor has already, you know, declared there's going to be a commission to look into fair wages and conditions in nail salons. So you feel like, you know, perhaps there'll be some oversight that's real. We are talking about The Price of Nice Nails, an expose in the New York Times about nail salons. Let's move on to our second topic, the selfie. But before we do that, we'd like to thank a sponsor, Smith & Noble. Smith & Noble is a wonderful company that helps with window treatments. They have something called an in-home design service, where an expert designer comes to your house, works with you one-on-one to design custom window treatments that are perfect for you. I have ordered several times for Smith & Noble, and as I've said before, learned a lot from them, because I recently redid my house, and I have only so much patience to deal with window treatments. I really do, like really small patients, but they like explain it to you quickly. I've gotten these kind of cool honeycomb shades for kids, heavier drapery. I've gotten all kinds of stuff for them, and it's always been an excellent experience. They have a great offer for our listeners. Save 20% off on window treatments, plus get free in-home service, only available for a limited time. Go to smithandnoble.com/XX today. That's smithandnoble.com/XX. Okay. Let's move on to our second topic, selfish. Kim Kardashian has a new book called Selfish. The book is entirely composed of hundreds of selfies of Kim Kardashian. There are baby Jenners who move into teenage Jenners. There's a teeny bit of Kanye, and not very much of the baby in there. Surprisingly little. Writes Laura Bennett of Slate in her review, Selfish is an insane project, a document of mind-blowing vanity and deranged perseverance. It's also riveting. I can't recommend it enough. I kind of feel the same way, I'm sorry to say. I bought it sort of the way one used to buy Playboy, like just like I went to a respectable bookstore And like almost felt like I had to earnestly explain to the guy that I was just doing research for my podcast. You know? I was not actually paying money. The guy was like, what the fuck is a podcast? Like he didn't care at all. But anyway, and I like shoved it deep into my backpack. But then as soon as I opened it, I mean, I just couldn't get enough of it. You know, it's one. And I would like your help in figuring out why. Like, what is the endless fascination of these pictures besides that she's good looking and has like a bizarre body?
Well, it's like a visual diary, right? So the book begins with the one of toddler Kim or little girl Kim kind of grabbing the camera and like early man with fire, you know, takes a photograph of herself. And then it jumps to 2006 where Kim Kardashian was beginning to get famous, but looked slightly different than she does now, shall we say, less contoured, less Kanye'd, sort of more innocent looking, if you could say such a thing about a Kardashian. And then you watch as she gets more and more famous and her face transforms. Everyone's does over the course of a decade, of course, but her face and her life circumstances and her surroundings all transform. And that to me is what's compelling about it.
Did you feel like she was having a fun life?
Oh, God, no.
But doesn't it seem kind of fun? It's like, oh, here's my friend Paris, and here's my other friend Beyonce, and we're going to the club, and then we're hiding out in the car. And, you know, the stuff she writes is so banal. It's like listening to Bruce Jenner talk. Like, just the actual ways she talks is like, I like having photos because they give me good memories. I mean, really, that's as sophisticated as the captions get. And then she'll say again, I really like the memories that I preserved in these photos. It's like shockingly banal. And yet somehow, I don't know, it's just a weird combination of stuff, like insane vanity, then complete ordinariness, you know. It's hard to make sense of. There's all this family around and jokes about the family. There's teeny, teeny moments of self-awareness, although not really a lot.
I think it's so touching that she's so confident and happy with her body. I mean, I can't remember, there was probably months ago now, when we had a hashtag topic about, you know, women in six words or something. And I think it was Amy Schumer who, you know, got hate mail for saying something like, I like myself, you know,
right.
And that's
right.
Such a radical position. And she really likes herself. And there's something kind of comforting and aspirational almost about that.
June, are you saying that Kim Kardashian's a feminist because she's subverted the male gaze and owned her own body and subverted celebrity culture and is empowered and we should all follow her example? Is that what you just said, June?
Did I?
Yeah.
I think you kind of did.
Well, there's a part. So I'm looking at the book now. It's sitting a few inches in front of me, probably about as far away as Kim holds the camera. And I'm looking at the side of it, and it's sort of, you see the white page edges, and then there's this section where the edges of the pages are black. And those photos are the more sort of, I don't know, sexy snaps, dirty snaps. I don't really quite know
naked.
What the word is.
Naked.
They're mostly naked.
How about naughty?
Naughty. Yeah, naughty. And so there's one of them, or a couple of them, where she says, gosh, I wasn't going to put these in the book, but they were in that iCloud hack, so they were in the Fappening. And she sort of gathered them and made them out there. And you think, that is revolutionary. She seems like she totally couldn't give a fuck in the best possible way. And I don't know, I'm not saying that that is like a modeling behavior for someone else, but it does seem, I mean, she got away with it for me. She convinced me that that's her feeling, and that feels kind of positive. I don't know.
She also has, here's another argument in favor of the feminism of Kim Kardashian, is the way that she talks about the makeup people,
yeah.
Like her male servants. Like, the men in this book are so in the background and in service to her. There's this kind of fake Jane Austen-y thing where the book ends with her getting married, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you think, oh, it's just a typical story. But in fact, like, there's no boys in the book at all. Like, she doesn't seem to care about them. Like, she cares about her sisters and her girlfriends and her BFFs.
No.
And everything.
She doesn't care about anyone but herself from the evidence in this book. I'm not saying that's true in real life, but I don't know that I want to make the argument that this is a feminist document. This is a document of narcissism, and this is a document of our, and I'm including all of us in this, our collective obsession with women's looks.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I would go so far as to call it like a feminist re-owning of those things. I think it's a simple taking those things on face value and doing as much as possible with those things.
Yeah, it's also a lot of work. That's the other thing, is that June, she'll say, oh, I love getting my makeup done. It's so relaxing. Yep. It's the most relaxing thing, getting my hair and makeup done. But it seems like her entire life, all day, every day, is like getting her makeup done and her butt lifted and whatever it is that it takes to keep the body that way all those years.
I know. I was sort of wondering, at some, like, or maybe this reveals my attitude to this thing, but I kept thinking, well, she likes having her makeup done. Is there anything that I consider, at least, like, not fun, like working out? I know a lot of people do find that fun, but, like, you know, the thing that's required to keep that body tight. And I don't know, obviously it's very curated, but that's kind of one of the joys of the selfie, that you're never taken unawares in a selfie. You never, you know, if you take a photo and you hate it, you just delete it. You do have a lot of power over the selfie. And what, there's 352 photos in this book, I think. Imagine how many selfies she has taken since 2006. And these are the ones that she has selected for our enjoyment and delight. And that is mind-boggling.
I just want to read my... Can I read you guys my favorite page?
Yes.
By the way, June, there's so many more selfies than the number you just said, because the thing I'm reading is on page 350, and there's many more pages after that. So there's like 400 and something. Anyway... It is her selfie that she takes in Thailand. And
is it one with the elephant?
It's on page 350. And she says, I don't think I've ever taken as many selfies as I did in Thailand. It's one of the prettiest places I've ever traveled to. It's like you judge the awesomeness of the place by how awesome you are in that place.
I have two responses to that. Number one, in my self-defense, I got that 352 photos of Kim stat from a review, and I know reviews are never wrong. So
That's true.
But the second thing is, there is a weird thing now with selfies. Like, I was just in Britain where there was a general election, and every single day we saw the leaders of the parties going out among the people and being, you know, having to pause while people take selfies with them. And I'm only presuming that, I guess here in the United States, maybe the security is too good for that, or too invasive to prevent ordinary people getting close to politicians. But that is now how we interact with either fame or beauty or, you know, the stuff that we, you know, want to be seen with. It is.
But doesn't that take a lot of chutzpah? Like, I remember I was interviewing Joan Rivers at a theater here, and it was a huge packed theater with all of her fans. And some young person who was standing up at the microphone to ask a question just walked up on the stage to take a selfie. And I thought, like, that's insane. Like, that's so presumptuous, you know? Or is it not presumptuous? Is it the opposite? Is it really empowering? Because people don't really, like, feel that much distance between them and celebrity or respect or awe or reverence or anything. They just feel like they can insert themselves because everybody's a semi-celebrity or everybody's a self-propagandist or, you know, everybody can be their own celebrity or insert millennial, you know, tag here.
Am I going to have to defend millennials here? Is this role
I'm looking at you. Yeah. I was going to send that at the old sprouted millennials.
Definitely, because I have to admit, like, I don't know about you, Jim, in my bones, I find the selfie a little alien. Like, the idea of taking tons and tons of pictures of yourself, I don't totally get why you want to see yourself. I see why it's, like, cool to see somebody else documented, like all those documents that people make of their kids or their spouse or whatever, and to see the change over time. But I'm not that interested in pictures of myself.
I think the idea of the selfie, and I'm not sure this applies to, like, taking it with celebrities, but I think the idea of, like, the selfie alone in your room or whatever is that you want to see yourself through others' eyes, mm-hmm. and this is the closest that you can get to it, that you don't trust the mirror because the mirror is somehow less impartial than the camera. And also, I think, you know, just on a, like, sheer aesthetic level, the angles are somewhat more flattering on selfies and people are responding to that. But yeah, I do think it's also a control thing.
Right, exactly.
But why do you want to record it? So you can see yourself through others' eyes by just looking in the mirror. So why is making a picture? This is good. We're getting somewhere. This is helping me. But, like, why is making a picture necessary?
You can, you know, zoom in. You can save it. You can return to it. You can, like, you can see what your selfies looked like in 2006 or 2009 or in Thailand. It's, yeah, I think it's, I don't know, maybe it's a... there's a great sense of impermanence in the world right now, and it's a way of just capturing something.
Okay, enough with the selfie. Let's move on to our last topic, men at work. But before we do that, we want to thank our second sponsor, Blue Apron, which is a new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm fresh ingredients, perfectly proportioned, and an easy to follow recipe card. You can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. They sent me a box to try out. It was awesome and delicious. We made a steak. We made some shrimp pasta. We had a great week of luxurious meals. You'll cook meals like pepper steak, roast potatoes, snow peas, little packages with all these cool condiments, and you can discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/XX, spelled out, D-O-U-B-L-E-X, to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/XX. Okay, men at work. A new study reported in the Harvard Business Review uncovers interesting dynamics about men in the workplace. Men, it turns out, are also plagued by the pressures to be the ideal worker and show unwavering dedication to the firm, but the rules about how they are and aren't allowed to get out from under that pressure are very different than they are for women. I found the study so interesting. It was a close anthropological study by a woman named Erin Reed at Boston University Business School. It's like an anthropology of an unnamed consulting firm. She interviews 100 people and discovers really interesting stuff. For example, okay, what happens, I'm asking you guys this, when men officially ask for time off the way women do? Like you say, oh, I just had a baby. I'd like to take my paternity leave, or I'd like to take, you know, 6 weeks off to be with the new baby. Good or bad for the men?
They're treated like women, which exactly. is to say that it's bad for them. They are sort of downgraded to daddy track.
Yeah. But isn't it they're treated like worse than women? Because with women, I mean, with women, it's like, oh, here she goes on the mommy track. But with men, there seemed to be like an added element of disdain. Like, what is wrong with you? You know, whereas with women, okay, she's just doing what a woman does. There was like an expectation problem if you asked the official way.
I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, they said that if you were treated differently when making that request than if you asked to take time off completely off the books to go on a luxury vacation, because that was like showing your hyper-masculinity, your success or whatever. However, I do think they're the same in the sense that they're both examples of people, bosses, just making assumptions about people and not really necessarily basing it on the facts about their performance or how much time they took off. Because in at least one of the examples that you're talking about, the guy asked, he was given pushback about, you know, taking too long, you know, for his paternity leave. So he put down his leave dramatically, and he still was treated as if he had taken, essentially as if he had taken all of the time that he'd originally asked for. And it was just in the way that I know I do this myself as much as I really try not to, but I do automatically think that women, mothers, are going to behave differently as workers than fathers are. And that's an assumption.
Wait, how do you think they're going to behave differently?
I think they're going to have more demands made on them. I think they're going to spend more time with their kids. I think they're going to be less likely. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I can't help it. I catch myself all the time making assumptions about how women, how mothers will behave in the way that I think it's kind of cool when guys do. I do think it's very cool when guys do it, but I don't necessarily expect it of them, whereas I presume that women are going to be kind of hands-on and have their time eaten up by their children.
Here's the new thing that the study brought up, which I didn't realize, which is that men are okay so long as they pass. In other words, they can find ways to get around. The bad thing for a man to do, apparently, is use the official channels. Like a man can't say, oh, I'm going to take officially X amount of paternity leave. But there were all these interesting ways in which she discovered that men do want to spend more time with their families, you know, take their kids to games or on vacations or whatever, but they find ways around the official channels. And that's not only expected and okay, it sometimes totally fools their bosses. And their bosses somehow weirdly end up like thinking of them as great workers. So ways to pass is like, if you have a sympathetic team and within your work team, everybody just kind of decides this is how we're going to work, but they don't tell the bosses, that's okay. Or there was the guy who took that ski vacation with his kid. Like he wanted to take a ski vacation. And that brought up the example, which I found astonishing, June, which you mentioned, that like that somehow like it, that somehow confirmed people's expectations of how this dude was like rich and behaving like a rich dude at a consulting company going on an awesome ski vacation, but he continued to work throughout. Like, there are all these ways you can, men can work the system. And I was thinking, like, why didn't women think of that, you know?
Well, now the secret's out and we should do it because it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
I planned
totally
to
brilliant.
Do that. Yeah.
It certainly did feel like there was a lot of rewarding of fronting. You know, if you just acted like, yeah, man, I'm working. What you talking about? And if you were getting it done and if people weren't complaining, then, yeah, I guess why not? But again, that's not how women do it.
Yeah, no, we got to learn to fight capitalism from within. Just
yeah, I mean, I don't think the women could get away with it because I think it's like...
Why not?
You have, I don't know, because it's like, it's a lot of it is expectations. They'll be like, okay, here we go. She's coming into my office. Time for the mommy track. You know, it's like they almost expect it to happen. So maybe they wouldn't believe you. Like, listen to what this guy said. This is a testimony from one of the guys. I skied 5 days last week. I took calls in the morning and the evening, but I was able to be there for my son when he needed me. And I was able to ski 5 days in a row. He clarified that these were work days, not vacation days. No one knows where I am. Those boundaries are only practical with my local client base, especially because we're mobile, there are no boundaries. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
And then,
No. Despite his deviance from the ideal worker expectation, senior colleagues viewed him as a star. One partner described him as a rising star who worked much harder than he himself did. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think how hard you work at work, it's so hard to quantify that in many jobs. And a lot of times the people who are actually doing the hard work and the scut work aren't the people who are sort of getting the credit. And part of me is like annoyed at the people who've learned to work the system. And part of me is proud and wanting to emulate them.
Exactly.
Know?
It does seem like, you know, these days we have all this mobility. We don't need to be tied to our desk. What that guy's doing is something that is possible these days. If he is still servicing his clients, he isn't doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so often we know of these new abilities. They're not that new anymore, but anyway, let's just go with it. We know of this, the possibilities that the mobile office affords us. And instead, we just use those possibilities to work when we get home. You know, we work at the office and then we work when we get home. We don't not work in the office.
Right.
Yeah, like, why aren't we using them to liberate us instead of to enslave us? Like, why, you know, it did, the stench off this study was that, like, women, this sort of Hillary Clinton problem, like, we're rule-bound and we follow all the rules and, you know, we are totally transparent and we never lie and we always go by the official channels and we don't know how to, like, you know, liberate ourselves from the man. That's what irritated me about this study.
Yeah, although I will push back a little and say that, you know, the mobile office can, as I think we've talked about on this podcast before, where it can sort of entrench into your personal life in a way that you might not want it to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also a fear. You know, there are a couple of women I work with who are mothers who are just the most efficient people in the office. And I think that's pretty common that, mm-hmm. that like, you just sort of get yourself in gear and you get your stuff done because you have to leave at 6 and you just like make people get stuff done because if it's not happening by 6, it's not happening. And I'm in favor of that as a model rather than letting it creep into evening.
Okay, except that here's the price for that model, which I have employed myself, is that you are kind of apart from office culture. Like, what's interesting about the men in this study who got away with it is that they still are part of the kind of palsy office culture, like, whoa, I want to be like that guy. He's so rich. He's so cool. Whatever. Whereas the women are behaving like moms. That's like time-honored mom behavior. Get it done by 6 o'clock. Don't hang out 1 second later. Don't have time for lunch. Like, you've sort of got – you're sort of stepped outside – you know, work culture.
You know, I'm going to do something very foolish now and say a word that you said so magnificently a little earlier, Hannah. Mm. Chutzpah.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the ingredients is that you have to have a lot of chutzpah. Like, I remember at Microsoft, not on our team, not at Slate, because it was, well, for various reasons, but I've observed many other teams where typically men, they just basically enforce long hours by, I've seen guys at the elevator very ostentatiously look at their watch and say to people, you're leaving already? And that is horrible. And yet, if what it takes to break that, as you say, to liberate from it, is to break the mold, then that mold needs to be shattered because it's horrible. And yeah, women aren't typically held to that kind of expectation for whatever reason. Depending on the team and depending on the woman. But there's something so vile about that that I wish just with all my heart that that could just be smashed into a million pieces.
They should do a remake of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but Ferris Bueller is a management consultant and he's figured out a way to just, like, you know, be a 50-year-old man having a great time but also calling clients.
Yeah,
Hollywood, get at me.
Women will still be doing the 9 to 5. You know,
like, still 9 to 5.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, it is annoying how for the women, it's like our responsibility to change the institution and change the institutional culture, and like men just working within the institution and getting to have it all, you know? Okay.
That was a really depressing note to end on.
Right, to bring us over.
We can end, we'll end on Bueller. Bueller. That's a much better idea.
All right.
All right, let's move to our recommendations. Before we do that, we want to thank our third sponsor, Great Courses. This week, we're looking at The Mysteries of Human Behavior, which is the psychology class you always wished you had taken, taught by Mark Leary, a professor of social psychology at Duke. Really cool subjects like what makes people happy or stressed out, why do we dream, is anyone really a psychic, how much are men and women really different, why do people fall in and out of love? Absolute answers to all of these questions. You don't listen, you're missing out. Can you imagine? I wish I could answer these questions, but you'll get closer. The Great Courses are celebrating their 25th anniversary. Over 500 courses and topics, history, science, literature, psychology, taught by great professors, top experts. You can watch or listen with DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or with the Great Courses app. There's a special offer for XX listeners. Order from 8 of the best-selling courses at thegreatcourses.com/XX. That's thegreatcourses.com/XX for 80% off the original price. thegreatcourses.com/XX. Okay, how about recommendations? I'm going to go first. I want to recommend a story that was in ESPN. It relates to the topic we discussed last week, which was Instagram. It's a very depressing story about Madison Hollerin, who was a runner at the University of Pennsylvania, who committed suicide. And the story suggests that a lot of the reason she did it is because of what the social media research suggests, that is, she couldn't make the distinction between her life and what she was seeing on her friends' Instagram pages, even though she told her mother, like, "Mom, those are just photos. My life is not really like that." She somehow assumed that all the lives of all her friends and everyone around her were really awesome while she was really depressed. Anyway, it's a wonderful close look at an athlete and all the stresses she faces and what happened to her. Okay, Noreen.
I have a film to recommend, Welcome to Me, which is the new Kristen Wiig movie, in which she plays a woman who has borderline personality disorder and then wins the lottery and goes off her meds.
Oh my God, I'm dying to see that.
And she did. And she's obsessed with Oprah, and the way she decides to spend her winnings is to create a TV show where she talks about herself called Welcome to Me. And it's a conceit that could easily fail, but she really pulls it off, and it's like really dark and weird and funny, and go see it.
Sounds excellent. June.
So this is potentially a pretentious recommendation since it involves going to another country. But if you happen to be in Britain, maybe you live there. Maybe you're visiting there. If you're in London, go to the Tate Modern and see the exhibit of Sonia Delaunay's work and life. It's amazing. I've been a big fan of Sonia Delaunay's for a long time, and I've seen much of her work. But this is a huge collection, 12 rooms, 12 different themes, including stuff that I had not seen before, including like her textile work, her fashion designs. This is a woman who lived 94 years, is often sort of thought of as the wife of Robert Delaunay, but had an amazing career, you know, born in Odessa in 1885 and could have ended, you know, a Jewish woman born in Odessa in 1885 and, you know, lived through two world wars and the Holocaust and pogroms and lived to 94. And was an amazing artist and entrepreneur, and it's a fantastic exhibit at the Tate Modern.
Sounds amazing. We'll head off to London immediately. Thank you to our producer, Anne Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. You can get more information about our show on the show page, slate.com/XX. Please go onto our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, for comments and suggestions about what we should talk about next. Email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you soon.
you do.